From our headquarters in Oslo, Norway, and on behalf of our host, Robbie Peralta, welcome to the Mnemonic Security Podcast.
Depending on where you sit, new regulations are either a pain in the neck or an opportunity for increased budget. Or just really boring to hear about. And in that case, feel free to hop off now and tune into some 80s rock. You have my blessing. While this episode does not contain legal advice, it does contain an introduction to what today's guest refers to as the House of Pain, or the Commission Implementing Regulation, EU 2023/203, to be exact. The too-long-didn't-read version? NIS2, DORA, the Cyber Resilience and Artificial Intelligence Acts. Rolf von Rossing, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
That von.
Yes.
What does that mean? Doesn't that mean you're like royalty or something?
Not quite royalty. It relates to what used to be an old title to the family, but okay. That went out in 1919 with the end of the German Empire. So it's nice and ornamental, okay. It's nice to have, but it doesn't mean anything nowadays.
Well, you are like Isaac, royalty in in one way or another. Right?
If you say that. Right.
Cool. So thank you for being here with us today digitally. You started your career as a head of IT, and then you moved on to Ernst & Young, and then you became the international vice president of Isaac. That while you're being a partner for KPMG. So you were a very busy man during those days, and yeah. As you are today. Then you moved on to the vice chair for Isaac Global, and now you are the CEO of Forefoot Consulting, which deals with senior level consultancy and advisory projects.
Yeah.
Royalty, Isaac royalty, summed up.
Well, if you're just around for long enough so everyone else is dead or pensioned off, then I guess that makes you royalty, end of the day.
I feel kind of bad. Like I feel like it's rude to sum up your whole career in that short of time. But
don't worry about it.
If it was any longer, it'd be like a biography. And that's like another episode for later.
It's so, not about what you've done. It's about what you're about to do.
Right? Good one. And what you're about to do, hopefully, is to walk us through something that I like what you call it. You call it the House of Pain. Upcoming regulations.
Yes.
Well, that depends who you talk to, though, because it could be the House of Pain for some, but it could be the House of Opportunity for others that are trying to get security budget.
So, yes, they
but
could.
We can figure that part out later. So would you mind sharing your PowerPoints?
I will be happy to. So thanks very much, Robbie. Now, to all of you, a very heartfelt and warm welcome to this little podcast around new EU cyber regulations. Some of you may have heard about it, and there are many rumors, but now they're beginning to come into force as we speak at the beginning of the year 2023. So I will take you through what we call the House of Pain or the House of Opportunity, depending on where you sit, and launch that right away.
There you go.
All right. So let's walk through the house from the very beginning and look at an overview of what we have to expect. At the top of the house, for certain reasons, we find that there's something called the EU Cybersecurity Act 2019, and I will go into this, why it is the top of the house rather than the bottom. We will then go through what's known as the Network and Information Security Directive version 1 and the new version 2, through the EU Cyber Resilience Act, the Artificial Intelligence Act, the DORA, the acronym stands for Digital Operational Resilience Act, and I will say a few words, but only very few, on the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, because that's fairly old. It's been around for several years and doesn't need any further detailed discussion. I will, however, relate that back to the other new acts that are coming and what the significance of data protection and privacy is. So let's start right away with NIS and NIS2. NIS2 reinforces and updates what used to be known as the Critical Infrastructure Protection Directive or Network and Information Security Directive. Originally, the EU was thinking that they need a common basis across the member states to identify critical infrastructures, to find out what they do, to make definitions around sectors and then provide some guidance as to what they have to do to actually protect. So with version 2, what we see is that there's a refined definition of what they consider essential and important entities. And that includes how they're classified in two annexes. There are annexes 1 and 2 that harmonize what is a critical entity or an important entity with the other acts to achieve a common definition. So for you now, it's probably much easier to decide and understand whether you yourselves in your company belong to critical infrastructure or whether some business partners, customers, or others belong to that category, such that you have to abide indirectly by the rules given by NIS2. It also establishes union-wide cooperation. So protection across the member states is now harmonized, so all countries are working together. And one of the organizations or committees that have been created is the EU Cyclone Network that will be introduced to manage wide-ranging incidents that affect critical infrastructures. For the first time, the EU has defined thresholds for entity sizes. So for micro and very small enterprises, some of these rules do not apply. However, for those that are under the new Act, there are much more stringent rules on risk management and criticality ratings. And finally, supervision, enforcement, and sanctions will now be defined in a more detailed manner, meaning the supervisory regime over critical infrastructure entities is now fully defined, not unlike banking supervision or insurance supervision.
Quick question there before we hop move forward. When it comes to sanctions, I've heard that NIS2 kind of puts teeth, kind of like GDPR did. Yeah, it was like
it does.
A percentage of your income, yeah. Whatever.
It stipulates administrative fines and penalties to the millions, same as GDPR. So I guess the EU is going that way to make sure that anything that they do by way of sanctions is pretty similar and follows a similar pattern. And we've seen with GDPR already that, yes, these fines are being imposed, although not always to the maximum. But it is enough to be painful, at least for most sort of companies that are not gigantic big tech.
Mm. Right. And then last question before we move forward. I mean, the million-dollar question for those that were used to NIS before, NIS2, like what does it mean for them now? Like what if you had to boil it down for, okay, we're used to NIS1, now we have NIS2, like what do they actually have to do to
I make think not much more than they've done already. So for those under NIS already, it means that, okay, your risk management is a little more articulate and criticality ratings require a little more careful self-assessment to make sure that you do it the right way. But the basics, the underlying basics are still the same. So for those who are already critical and used to that, it is just a refinement of what was there before. What they could also expect is perhaps that supervisory interest and activity is a little more comprehensive than before. Now that they're creating the right sort of organizations and supervising bodies, there may be more audits, there may be more requests for information, but generally the substance of what has to be done has not changed.
Yeah, cool.
Okay.
Thank you.
So let's move on swiftly. The EU Cybersecurity Act. Now you said putting teeth to what they want. This is what happens. The mandate of ENISA has now been extended. Do you remember that it was originally created in 2004 as a temporary organization? However, it is now solidified and ENISA is now called the EU Cybersecurity Agency. It changed its name and it specifies its quite wide-ranging advisory and consultative powers. So they are still an advisory body, not a regulator, but they are also expected now to closely work with and interact with other EU institutions, amongst others the banking supervisory authorities, to make sure that things like the EBA guidelines or the SREP are in line with the overarching sort of cyber framework and expectations. It also introduces a European cybersecurity certification framework that is to be enacted by accredited bodies in member states. You probably have to imagine that like ISO 27001 certification, where you have sort of a common standard, and then you have accredited certification bodies that audit entities and companies against that. So the Act covers anything that's to do with information and communications technology, products, services, and processes. It then introduces the notion of conformity, same as you would have with an ISO standard, including assessments, self-assessments, and assurance levels. The assurance levels are harmonized with what we saw before, basic, substantial, and high, and then conformity is defined according to various technical standards and specifications. So in the House of Payne, this means that we now have a great body that is advising and harmonizing between all the others, and that is trying to bring all of these ducks in a row to make sure that entities, companies working in the union have an overarching picture of what's happening. You could possibly call this a little bureaucratic. Yes, I would agree with you. In the grand scheme of things, I guess that for larger firms, it does mean a little more administrative effort. On the other hand, it is probably creating a level of certainty saying, well, wherever we go in the union, we're facing the same challenges, but also the same requirements.
Yep. Cool.
Let's move on.
Crystal clear.
Cyber Resilience Act. Okay. Now, here we go. This is where the teeth come in. So you have to imagine that, you know, on a rainy day in Brussels, you have people sitting there in their offices. They're looking out. It's grey. They don't want to go, not even out for a smoke, but they have 8 hours to spend during the day. So what are they going to do? Well, they're thinking about new rules and regulations because that is their job. So in this sense, someone came up with the idea of harmonizing products with digital elements, which pretty much covers everything. So if you take a smartphone, and let's hold that into the camera if you can see me, that smartphone is full of digital elements. However, if you go a little further, things like car keys, things like little devices that you carry around, gadgets, they're also full of digital elements. So that has created a very, very wide-ranging definition of what comes under this new act. So there are three assurance levels, basic, substantial, and high. And you will remember from the previous slide that this is also what the Cybersecurity Act stipulates. And these three levels are the core of what you have to do with products in future. Basic says the product must meet basic requirements covering the risk of basic cyber attacks. And once you evaluate these products, you must include a technical documentation review. Is everything there? Is it clear? Is it articulate enough? You can use alternative evaluation methods if they're equivalent to documentation review. Now, please do not try to take a hammer, smash the car key, do destructive testing, and then see whether it's secure. That's not what they mean. So, moving on to substantial. You have to minimize the known cybersecurity risks, not just basic requirements, and you have to cover the risk of incidents and attacks that are carried out by actors with limited skills and resources, whatever that may mean. I have no idea what an attacker with limited skills and resources looks like. You can say, okay, it's a script kiddie, but you could also say anything or anyone short of a nation state has limited skills and resources by definition. So here, you must add appropriate testing of the product and testing evidence on top of reviewing the documentation that comes with it. And alternative evaluation methods are permitted if they're equivalent. Again, appropriate testing is probably more towards the firmware, the hardware, and other things. And like I said in the beginning, the word appropriate here is very difficult to gauge because you don't know what appropriate testing actually means. So we will have to wait for a while down the line to see how that plays out and what appropriate means in the eyes of the regulator and the union. Assurance level high then, which again is a beautiful piece of legalese writing. In order to be high, you have to minimize the risk of state-of-the-art cyber attacks carried out by actors with significant skills and resources. Now, how do you defend against the state-of-the-art cyber attacks when state-of-the-art means that they're doing something that hasn't been done before and is fairly new? Also, if you look at actors with significant skills and resources, again, it begs the question, who are these guys? What's significant? So we have to wait. The interpretation of these things is not going to be that easy. And here, the bar is set really high because it says evaluation must cover the absence of publicly known vulnerabilities, as in there can be no CVEs against this product or its components. It must cover pen testing actively, and it must cover resistance to skilled attackers. So whatever a skilled attacker is, again, so the whole works here indicate that, yes, it's well meant, but it will need a lot of interpretive activity to finally determine what these things mean and how you get to a level of substantial or high.
Before you move on there, so basically if, just use an example, let's say I make child watches. I make watches, digital watches that are marketed towards children.
Yes.
Whether that's assurance level substantial or assurance level high, that could be debated. But basically if I'm to get hacked and, you know, children's data, things go out there, what happens then? Is it that I get a fine or I have to go before ANISA and explain ourselves, like explain our processes and what we're doing? And like where's the teeth here?
An interesting case. Thanks for that one. So let me go through that step by step. Assume you have a smartwatch, and that smartwatch synchronizes with all your other devices. So if you do not achieve the same assurance level, or if you will, protection level, that you would have on your desktop device, like the laptop I'm looking at, then there's a risk. Because obviously, if some data that requires the assurance level high, like children's personal information, most definitely, if you have one device that has high and the other device has only basic, if something comes out, if there's a data breach, you're liable under this act as well as under the GDPR. So reporting will have to be done to the requisite authorities on this act, cyber resilience, but also parallel reporting within 72 hours to the competent data protection authority in the member state where it happens, or any other competent authority where a data subject may have a complaint or have an inquiry about it. In both cases, you may face dual fines for the same thing. It is not determined yet whether a GDPR fine that is already given to you will offset the cyber resilience fine, but that is for the courts of law and for the data protection authorities to define in future.
So basically, if you make a thing and it has a digital component in it, no matter how big or how little, you definitely need to sit down and have a proper thought about, you know, where you are in this assurance level and what your risk is given something bad happens, right?
I mean, it's a very clear roadmap. First off, you have to sit down and say, well, what is the information asset that I'm actually planning to process or use or store? Now, that is known, and you usually do a protection level analysis. You do an inheritance analysis in your IT corporate backend where you say, well, if the protection level for confidentiality is high, I will probably have to do something. That's a well-known thing, doesn't need further explanations. However, if you now go to the IoT, things with digital elements, you will have to make sure that inheritance from your corporate backend of the protection level to that device is correct. So you do not get yourself backdoors or unintended weaknesses and vulnerabilities in there. And what this act now means is that if you have common, well-defined assurance levels, you can use them for any of your products to say, well, if my information asset has a protection level of high or very high in that definition, then presumably I should also have a cyber resilience assurance level of high. And it only means that you should probably add this act to what you do in your ordinary protection level analysis around your information assets and the devices that you're using them on.
This is like a good example of opportunity for security people. Like, hey, you have this cyber resilience act for our data.
Robbie, if you can tell me where they are, these security people, I will hire them all. Yes.
We need them ourselves. Yes, cool.
Okay. Right. So let me move on. Just to give you the sort of analysis of what this does. The Act covers any products with digital elements. That's very far-reaching, and it's a wide definition. It covers literally anything that's connected to some form of network. It may be your car, it may be your house, it may be your digital smartwatch. So it means any software or hardware product and its remote data processing solutions, including software or hardware components, to be placed on the market separately. So even if you just produce components that have some network connectivity, some digital elements, then Article 3.1 says that, yes, they fall under the Act. It furthermore distinguishes between critical and highly critical products, and there are increased control requirements as an analogy to the assurance levels. And anyone who wants to put these into the European market will have to face increased documentation requirements. Again, here is bureaucracy, but it's probably unavoidable to have that sort of thing if you want to be reasonably precise. So importantly, as someone putting products into the Union, you must identify and remediate vulnerabilities. So once you have taken note of a vulnerability, you have to address that. It's not enough to say, well, yes, it's out there, but we're not going to do anything about it. Consequently, the old problem in IoT of the firmware upgrades or, you know, the software upgrades that are infrequent, that are slow, is going to become more critical. Likewise, if you take smartphones, the problem of the middle layer that is branded by the mobile provider and then the phones are subsidized to be brought into the marketplace. Again, the original manufacturer of the device and of the firmware and software will not be able to resort to that sort of defense that says, well, but it wasn't us, it was the mobile provider adding on a layer of branded content that caused the flaw. You will still be liable in the chain of events. So for those who have a product that gets branded by a third party and then put into the market, watch that supply chain, because it's going to be a very critical point. Conformity assessments will be required. That costs money and is a fairly cumbersome exercise. Some of you who are old enough may remember the old conformity assessments under ISO 15408, Common Criteria, and others. There is, again, a point to note, mandatory exploit or incident reporting. Something happens to your product, you must report. It is mandatory, it is not discretionary. And active market surveillance, which in itself sounds a little threatening, will be introduced, including significant penalties. So authorities will monitor the markets and they will monitor breaches and incidents. If your product has a flaw, if that gets exploited, even as a proof of concept, you have to prepare a strategy for reporting that and for also tracking and tracing your remediation procedures and report those as well. So for those in finance, this is not new. But for most other sectors, this is a new thing.
This is actually really, really, really big.
Yes, it is.
For everybody that makes things. And I guess kind of one negative consequence of this is it kind of raises the bar. It raises the barrier of entry, I guess, into these sort of markets.
On the one hand, it does. On the one hand, it does, Robbie, because now you have to sort of meet the criteria that are out there. On the other hand, it's a bit like the Schengen Accord for the freedom of movement. You know, once you've achieved it in one country, you're free to go to all other member states without any further assessments or any additional sort of bureaucratic work. So it's pros and cons to this one.
And at the end of the day, this is all meant to protect us, Robbie and Ralph, as a consumer, right? That's the whole point.
Yes, mostly it is. Okay,
cool.
Let's move on. Oh, this is my favorite, the Artificial Intelligence Act. So the Act governs the placing on the market, putting into service, or the continuing use of artificial intelligence. And that covers the manufacturers as well as the continuing users. So if you use AI, even if you buy that in as a service, you share the responsibility for its use. Now, let that one sink in. You know, you touch it, you're liable. So it's not just the people making the AIs and deploying them. It's also you if you use them. An example, if you're a health insurer and you use AI, for instance, to analyze how often people go to the doctors, to the hospitals, how often they do their routine checks or they don't do their routine checks. It is common practice to do that, but if you do it manually, human intelligently, there's a little problem around it. Let's put it like that. If you use an AI to do that, suddenly you fall under the provisions of this act. What it also means is, the healthcare example is a good one, that if you do that, you are falling under the category of so-called high-risk AIs. There are several examples, and there's a whole annex that says, what are high-risk AI applications? And certainly anything that handles sensitive personal information is high-risk AI. The reason for doing that is that the union thought, well, if it's people doing, at least you have people supervision, and they can be governed and guided by the various policies, procedures, whatever. You have legal recourse against people, and you have also sanctions against people as appropriate, criminal or civil. What do you have against a piece of software? Can you take a piece of software to court? No. Can you take a piece of software and, you know, assume criminal liability? No. Can you indeed bring criminal or civil proceedings against the manufacturer of that software? No, you can't, because once the AI has been unleashed and is working somewhere else, you can always bring the defense that says, well, we manufactured the AI, we deployed it off the shelf, it was naked, and then it started learning at the client side, inside the firm. That learning is no longer our liability, our responsibility. So you see that the transition from using humans to using AI is indeed a huge one, because it effectively takes away any legal remedy against the AI itself or its originator. Hence the need for an act like this that tries to bridge that gap and bring in sort of an accountability even for the user, being conscious of the fact that once you acquire it, once you put it to work, it's your dog. You know, you take it from the kennel, and that moment, it's your dog, and you mind your dog, you know. It makes a poo in the corner, you pick it up. It bites someone, you're liable, and you're responsible. So that sort of thing was behind thinking that continuing users of AI should assume accountability. So, also important for you, and legally speaking, this is very problematic, but it'll have to be seen how this plays out. The Act introduces the concept of reasonably foreseeable misuse. And that is a powerful but extremely pessimistic judicial construct. What it says is that users of AI, as well as manufacturers and other people offering it, must reasonably foresee any misuse that might happen with the AI. So you have to have almost clairvoyant foresight, saying, well, if I use this AI, if I do something with it, already at the beginning, day one, I have to imagine all sorts of potential misuses, you know, malpractices, other things around this AI. I have to note them down. And if I reasonably foresee them, I have to do something preventive to actually avoid this from happening. So it's pessimistic, and it puts the burden of proof on the AI user or the AI manufacturer even before something has happened. Liability arises if you fail to reasonably foresee what might happen in the future. Because other lawyers can come and say to you, but you should have seen that, shouldn't you? Reasonably foreseeable misuse. So it's powerful. We have to see what happens with this. Also, the Act provides a negative list of prohibited AIUs, and that's a long list of things you really can't do. Example, you cannot do something in public that would recognize, automatically identify individuals in a crowd, other things. That is not allowed, and there's a long list of other things. Exemption clauses exist for state actors, factual users like, you know, voice and face recognition in the crowd. Yes, of course, police, law enforcement can do it. They have to. But these are the only exemption clauses that exist for the use of AI in a prohibited manner. And you find annexes that will, like I said, give you the high-risk AI applications as types and categories, but it's not exhaustive. So it always says, well, there may be others that also fall into this category. If we haven't listed them here, nevertheless, you be careful. So for anyone trying to use AI despite this sort of act coming their way, you will have to have a compulsory risk management system. You will have quite wide-ranging human oversight requirements, so the AI must be controllable at all times, it must be transparent, and its acts and omissions must be traceable in the past by log files or others. So anything the AI has done or decided must be traceable for an informed third party auditing this retrograde. And then the usual provisions around cybersecurity and resilience will apply, but we've seen that with the previous ones. So here it is. It's boring and dry, but if you look behind the scenes, actually, this is a huge one coming our way.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't see anything there being like unfair. It seems all like fair and smart. Like ChatGPT is a great example of that, right? Mm. How you're not allowed to use that tool to, I can't ask it things about myself personally. Mm-hmm. So it's prohibiting the use of its AI against people, because obviously that would be misused for negative reasons. So sure. Yeah. They're slowing down the development of Skynet, I guess.
Well,
which is good.
You know,
responsible AI.
The Skynet thing. I guess, yeah, well, you could turn yourself into a Robbie avatar because you're too lazy to do podcasts anymore. And then the avatar could speak to people like me. No, that's a no. And in that sense, I agree with you. There have to be certain limitations and there have to be certain regulations around it. My caveat here would be, again, as in most European settings, do not overregulate that to the point that it's impossible to use it. Well meant is not necessarily well done, but this one, again, leaves a lot of room for legal and technical interpretation, so we'll have to see in future how it is actually used.
Yeah, I feel like everything you presented so far has a room to wiggle around and justify, and so that's
it certainly does. Right.
Hmm. Cool.
So, last one, DORA. This one is this one's candy for the bankers. What does that do? It introduces operational resilience requirements for financial institutions and their ICT providers. So that's very new, because before, any regulation across and around Europe was for financial institutions only, and now they've added on explicitly their ICT providers. If you remember, third-party providers before were covered under the outsourcing rules. Now they have their own sort of supervisory regime. So we have a wider definition of financial institution. Anything that smells of money is in, basically, and there are only small exemptions for micro-enterprises. And this act now mandates the full ITGRC framework plus business continuity and resilience. In a nutshell, it combines what we used to have as different disciplines. We used to have business continuity, IT service continuity, security, risk, and so forth. Now, this is all coming under one umbrella where it says operational resilience includes all of the above and asks you to do a little more. It's not designed badly. However, it will probably initiate a lot of organizational change in financial institutions, because they cannot have all these disciplines in this act as silos anymore. There will have to be a move towards, if you will, an integrated critical infrastructure protection function. And that's new, but I can say from my experience in the banking sector and, you know, sort of recently talking to folks there, that DORA requires more cooperation and a more seamless kind of approach inside the bank or inside the financial organization. So it tells you about risk management. Again, nothing's new, but it combines it with technology resilience, a full ISO-compatible ISMS, duty to use state-of-the-art technology and processes, which puts a lot of pressure on the IT folks who are under cost pressure but now need to be state-of-the-art. And here, I quote Article 8.3a to d, it has teeth because it says enterprises must guarantee, a very strong legal word, guarantee the security and data protection. So that means the Act emphasizes the burden of proof on the bank to guarantee that everything's in order and everything's hunky-dory. Before, there used to be some wiggle room, but this now closes certain doors, so you really have to do your homework.
So if Demonic is a provider to per definition, a provider of IT services to a bank, right? Then we're also under that act then.
Yes, you are, provided you're of a certain size and criticality. This does not necessarily apply to small ICT providers. It does not necessarily relate to the occasional purchase of products or services by a bank. No, this is about the huge ICT providers that are systemically critically for the sector. Example, if everyone uses 365, then Microsoft's on the list for this one. I guess for these very large ones, it shouldn't present any problem because they are fairly good at what they're doing already. There may be some others that are systemically relevant for a certain class of financial institutions, say specialized software providers for core banking in one member state. And if that's a favorite product used by the banks there, then that provider may find themselves under the act here because they are systemically relevant for the banking sector in that country. So that may happen. Yeah.
Question. Why? It kind of seems like DORA is sort of like NIST, but for banking.
It is like NIST for banking because let me jump to the next slide. Thanks very much. Yes, it does follow the five NIST phases. It does so verbatim. And it sets high-level requirements, but it doesn't go beyond NIST as such. So if you've done your NIST framework, you are probably okay as a financial institution, with a caveat that guaranteeing the security and the state of the art is obviously something that NIST never asked. But that's an add-on to say, well, how seriously should you take the NIST requirements?
They can afford it.
Well, yeah. There's a requirement to do mandatory lessons learned processes and post-incident reviews. Again, something that NIST recommends, but it doesn't really mandate that. But this act does now. There's duty to communicate on incidents and have a person doing so, a staff position. Whether that's part or full-time is probably a function of your size, but like having a data protection officer, here you go, if you're under DORA, you must have a person to report and deal with incidents. So duty to report, introduction of mandatory testing that goes to the business continuity, disaster recovery side of things, and this testing must be realistic enough, not just tabletop, to make sure that you're kicking the tires. And if you're using other service providers, like the old banking regulation, you are required to apply that framework to other third parties. So if you use me as a consultant to help you with some of your banking problems, the DORA requirements should also apply to me, depending on the context of what I do and the criticality of what I do. If I'm your external information security officer, yes, everything applies. If I'm just like cleaning the floor down at ground floor, then probably not. And the Act sets up a parallel supervisory framework that covers ICT providers directly that resembles the current banking supervisory regime. That says that the regulators can now go to IT providers directly, even without the knowledge or the consensus of the bank behind it. And I told several ICT providers already across Europe, and I said, guys, you realize that we as a bank, when working with you, we can point out your flaws and weaknesses. You can complain about it and say, well, contract change, yes, it costs more money and so on. But please be advised that the regulator can knock on your door even without our knowledge. We cannot protect you if something goes wrong. So you be aware of that. Now, yeah, that caused a bit of near panic because they were saying, well, oh, but what do you mean? I said, well, they can audit you anytime they want. They don't have to ask us, the bank, anymore. And it's not our responsibility if you do something and they come and audit you. They can impose fines against you directly. Ah, oh, that's different. Well, but there you go. So that's the thing for now. Lots of dry bureaucracy, but I hope it's been a little instructive in terms of giving you practical examples of what that might mean and what the paper tiger might do in reality.
Thank you very much, Rolf. How much time do we have? I mean, are all these things, like the DORA, Resilience Act, the Artificial Intelligence Act, are they rolling out at the same time? Okay, March, whatever, 2025, boom? Or is it different dates for all of them?
Well, there is a boom date for most of them. And as you can see, when they come out, they will give you sort of advance notice, but it won't be too long. So usually from our experience, from the initial publication to the mandatory end, when you have to be compliant, it is between 18 months and 2 years. And if you remember GDPR, that was announced in 2016, even 15, so you could see the shape and how it was developing. And they said, well, 25th of May 2018 should be enough for everyone to sort of get familiar with that. So expect them to come in by way of publication pretty soon, one by one. When you have to be compliant is open. So I can't predict that.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Start working on it.
Yeah, sorry. I think
your lights got turned off.
Yeah, it looks like we're having an electrical problem, but I have a battery.
All right. Well, I can see you totally fine.
Okay, good.
But yeah, just before we round off here, the GDPR actually ended up working out. I mean, I remember when that happened, everybody was freaking out, and I thought it was going to, you know, end the world. But yeah, it seems like there hasn't been too many big fines that people have heard about. So the companies did their work, and it's protected the consumers. It's very annoying with all those cookies things, but yeah, it seems like it worked out. You expect the same with all these?
I think so. I mean, GDPR has been halfway a success story. And yes, there have been quite big fines. Remember, you know, that there were GDPR fines about 200 million or more for British Airways and a couple of others. So yes, there are those big fines. But I think by and large, we will get used to this sort of more of a clarification of what is needed than actually new rules that no one was expecting. And let's face it, you know, in some settings, you have a lot of companies that when they're under cost pressure and they try to sort of do things as efficiently as possible, they may need a bit of persuasive activity by the regulator to do the minimum and to do it continuously and constantly. So to sum that up, I would say buying an expensive motorcycle, going fast, but then arguing with a policeman that you didn't have money for the helmet, that's not going to work anymore.
It's not going to work anymore.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Rolf, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and taking the time to join us here today. Good luck with the power there in the background.
Yes, I hope it'll work in a few minutes then again. Huh? All right, Robbie. Thanks very much for moderating
this. We'll see you around.
Okay. I'll see you.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon.
Have a good
one. Well, that's all for today, folks. Thank you for tuning in to the Mnemonic Security Podcast. If you have any concepts or ideas that you'd like us to discuss on future episodes, please feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn or to send us a mail to podcast@mnemonic.no. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.